Sylvan Esso providing our soundtrack this morning. Now, you could ask why play Sylvan Esso? Well, first of all, beautiful voice. First of all, second of all, great music. Third of all, it is one of the favorites of our producer, Sarah LaDuke, who is celebrating a birthday today. So we want to wish Sarah, our producer, a very, very happy birthday on this 12th day of February.
We sure do. She is terrific, isn't she, Joe?
She's absolutely the best. So we wish her a very, very happy birthday, and we'll be listening to some cool tunes this morning in her honor. So happy birthday, Sarah, and good morning, everybody. Hey, welcome. It's Friday. It's the 12th of February, and it's good to be with you. We love being with you, and we're thrilled that you are with us. Let me introduce the group. I just want to remind you, you can be a part of the program, panel at WAMC.org, and that's all you have to do, and we'll get your letters, and we read some of them. We can't read all of them because we just get too many, but we read as many as we can, and sometimes, you know, people say, well, you didn't read my letter, and they go, well, yes. You're right. We didn't read your letter because it was similar to other letters, and we just sort of compiled them. And you know, people understand. They really don't. But they should. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Okay. Let me introduce the group to you. Aaron Pasitti is here. I'm sorry. Alan, my God, I heard you talk and I thought I had already introduced you. I apologize. Alan Chartok is here, ladies and gentlemen.
The right kind of assumption. I had jumped the pony, and therefore, you know, there's no question.
I forgot.
Whatever that metaphor was.
Shark. You jumped the shark.
Thank you, Judith.
Yeah, jump the shark.
Jump the shark. That's right.
It's a Fonzie. Anyway. A Fonzie reference when the Fonz jumped the shark.
And I have a very good friend who always refers to me as shark attack. So,
it's a shark talk. Yeah, shark talk, I got it. Shark. Yeah.
But anyway, cool. It's a hell of a morning, and we're about to see a defense come up from from the defenders, and they are basically announcing, hey, we got this and we're not going to do much.
Well, we'll see. That's what I think is funny. We're going to defend the indefensible, but it should only take us about 2 hours.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go on to introducing our wonderful panel. Siena College economics professor Aaron Pasitti is with us. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning. I was really excited about maybe getting top billing, so now I feel deflated.
I'm sorry. I screwed that all up this morning. You'll always get top billing in our heart, Aaron.
Certainly in mine.
Thank you.
David Soares is with us, Albany County District Attorney. Good morning, David. How are you?
Good morning, everybody. I just want to echo what you said earlier. Happy birthday to Sarah and Casey. I'd like to dedicate the Flame by Cheap Trick to Sarah on her birthday.
I'm sorry, that was Casey Kasem. Is that who you're asking
Casey
for?
Casey Kasem.
Yep.
I'm showing my age, man. American Top 40, bro.
It's a long distance dedication and request, right? Yeah.
And you want to know about my age? I don't even know who the guy is. Casey Kasem.
Well, he's long past. He was a radio DJ for a long time, and the voice of Scrab. No, say what?
Shaggy.
Oh yeah, but it was Shaggy, right? Yeah, he was the voice of Shaggy and Scooby Doo. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But don't worry, Alan. That show jumped the pony a long time ago.
Jump the ghost. Yeah. And you know, I think of this billing in doing it this way, now that we're talking about billing. We're mentioning Judith last, but it's like they do on the West Wing, Judith and Martin Sheen. You know what I mean? Like, you just wait, like, and Judith Eng.
Why, thank you, Joe. I am the West Wing. Amazing. I want to join you in wishing Sarah LaDuke a happy birthday. She is a treasure. And when I hear her, on WMC, I am transfixed when I hear her voice. She has such an NPR voice.
Yeah.
And she asks such good questions.
She's amazing.
She's amazing. Yeah. And, you know, happy 30th birthday, Sarah.
I didn't mention what Judith does, but Judith is a senior fellow and visiting professor of Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics, former EPA regional administrator. But as I said, and Judith Inc. All right, let's get to the business at hand. And we have a lot of it, as Alan mentioned. So we'll get to it and start the fun and frivolity of today. Let me... Well, we'll talk impeachment. As Alan indicated, we're finally going to get to the House managers wrapped up their argument yesterday, and so now it's Donald Trump's turn. His defense will go before the managers to say what's on their mind. But the impeachment managers rested their case, imploring the Senate to convict to prevent future violence. That was a case that was made several times throughout the proceedings yesterday, wrapping up against it, imploring the Senate to convict him because they say, "We humbly ask you to convict President Trump for the crime for which he is overwhelmingly guilty of, because if you don't, if we pretend this didn't happen, or worse, if we let it go unanswered, who's to say it won't happen again?" Now, Trump's legal team is poised to respond on Friday, arguing that he should be acquitted. They are expected to use only one of two allotted days. A verdict could come as early as the weekend. All right, Alan, let's start. This is taking less time than any of us expected, I think. There were some early projections that this could go into next week. It won't. So, or by all likelihood, it won't. So where do you think we are right now?
Well, we know where we are, and that is that some of the obsequious, cowardly, lack of backbone, spineless Republicans who are sworn jurors are not following their oaths. We also know that some of it is coming apart. We know that because Nikki Haley, of all people, is being reported by CNN to have said basically she's not following this president anymore, who has deceived the American people, and, quote, he's fallen so far. That's extraordinary. And you know, if she's going, and she is often mentioned as a potential Republican presidential candidate, she's putting her finger up in the air and seeing which way the wind is blowing. And the miscreants on the other side who have sworn allegiance to Trump must be noticing that. Because, you know, once people start to jump off the sinking ship, there are an awful lot of bodies in the water. I'm thinking that... you know, it's probably not going to happen, but the Democrats have done a superb job. I've been criticized for saying the Democrats, let's put it this way, the House managers, who happen to be Democrats, have done a superb job of putting all of this together. And I don't think there's any other way out of it. This is nothing but a disaster for the Republican Party.
You bring up such a great point. David, let me ask you, as district attorney, you know, in my mind, agreeing with Alan, you can't think that the House managers could have possibly put together a better case than they did. They put it together, and yet they still probably, as of this moment, will not prevail.
You know, I want your audience to understand that although a lot of what's being discussed and presented is being discussed and presented in the context of a trial, this is nothing like your a traditional trial. In other words, you know, prosecutors don't present cases to a jury that consists of victims, witnesses, and unindicted co-conspirators. And that's the challenge that the prosecutors in this instance bear, right? You know, I will say this, Jamie Raskin and the team that has been put together around him, they have done an incredible job. They've done Let me just say that it's about as close to perfect as you can find, because what they've done is they've personalized this experience so much. And as I said, the jury here consists of victims, witnesses, and unindicted co-conspirators. And subtly, they've managed to project this case in a way that speaks to them in the context of who they are in those three categories. Hence the reason why Hawley and others have left the environment, are sitting in different places, pretending not to pay attention. They're the unindicted co-conspirators in all of this. And for some of our jurors, we've seen the re-traumatization of these folks as they've gone over, you know, the last 4 days. And so it has been an incredible thing to witness. They've done a fantastic job. Their mixture of videotape, audio, dispatch recordings, it's really presented it's forced every viewer to go right back, almost in a time machine, like to relive that experience. And it certainly put those Republican jurists who will have to vote, it has put them in a very difficult place. The only objective today for Trump's defense team, and this sounds odd, they're not having the burden of going out there to convince anybody of anything. The only thing that they have to do is present a small lifeline to those people that don't want to vote against President Trump. And if they can just dangle that lifeline out there a little bit today, you'll find the Rubios and all of those folks who want to appear as though they're pro-law enforcement, you will find that they will jump on that. It's not constitutionally sound for us to do this lifeline that the defense, in their hopes, will float to them today.
Judah, think.
Well, I think it's fairly obvious that the House managers were speaking to the public, the American public, more than, you know, Lindsey Graham or Ted Cruz or Hawley. Because if you convince the public, then you see the conversions of the Nikki Haley's of the world, because they see that there's no public support for armed insurrection in our state capitol. Imagine that, federal capitol. So what they were doing was establishing the public record, and I think they did it incredibly effectively. I think even if there is not a conviction, Trump is politically wounded. If he was thinking of not only running again, but when he makes threats against people who are not loyal to him, I don't think it's going to have the political potency that it would have had a few months ago. And I just want to say how incredible Representative Jamie Raskin was. We all know his personal story. I mean, to lose a son and then to the next day be leading the presentation in the House. I mean, I don't know how this guy keeps going, but what a patriot Jamie Raskin is. And then my final borderline ridiculous point is, I think that if these proceedings were on Zoom today with the two Trump attorneys rather than in person, is there any question that the Trump attorney would open his Zoom presentation with, "Your Honor, I am not a cat. I am a real person."
Can I ask you a question, Judith, because it's been bothering me a lot, and it's not going to be a popular thing for me to say. But I'm concerned about this idea that many Democrats are saying, yes, it's very important he not be allowed to run again and bring this chaos back to us a second time, because it would be, and he would mm-hmm. be doing all of those things. I'm very concerned because I think there are a lot of people in middle America who don't get that, who think that if somebody wants to run for office, they should be allowed to. Now, as you know, I'm behind no one, and I mean no one, when it comes to the condemnation of Trump's behavior. But I also have a tremendous sense that the American people know what's going on here. And I think this continual call for not letting him run again is a mistake. It's a mistake because of middle America not because of the blue Democrats, but because there are many people who will say, well, that's just not right.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, that I think you're right about that, but it is the law of the land. If you are impeached, you then can have a majority vote not allowing the person to run. That some people may not want to get into the intricacies of that, but in terms of what's best for the country, of course, on one hand, everyone should have the right to run, but what Trump did was just so beyond the pale. I think people that want Trump to have the right to run are people that are not going to be concerned about the violence, the death, the damage that was done on January 6th anyway.
Not to cause too much trouble, but I take a certain amount of unhappiness with that statement because, mm-hmm. you know, because I do, you know, I do find this guy to be as reprehensible and as a bigger danger to this republic that we have ever had. I am just concerned about his doing it again. And mm-hmm. if you try to basically tell him he can't run again and you lose, and it looks like you will lose, this becomes a point in the argumentation of those people. And I know who's listening to this radio station, and I know what I'm bound to get for this. But you really do put an arrow in the quiver for Trump the next time he tries it.
We have to take a break, so I'm going to pause there, and we can respond when we come back. We have a bunch of letters as well. We welcome your response, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares with us this morning. We will continue our conversation, and again, welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We will return after this news break from the BBC. I was gonna die young. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable and our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares. We welcome you to the broadcast, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We ended with Alan's thoughts on this subject. David, would you like to respond in any way?
Well, I think that's exactly the point that Ted Lieu was trying to make, wasn't it? The fact that, and I don't know if people missed this, but he ended his remarks by saying it's not about him running again that we should be, you know, cautious about, because the Democrats have no fear of beating him. It's him running again and losing and what that's going to trigger. And I thought that was a very powerful statement, and I'm appreciative of Alan bringing that up again. But I think if the concern is, are the Democrats making too much of him not having the opportunity to run for office again, and whether or not that will be weaponized in the political theater. Well, what's preventing him from doing that now? He's weaponized everything, right?
Alan?
Yeah. You know, there's always an argument to be made on both sides of these things. I am concerned only about one thing, and that is, does this help Donald Trump? And my feeling is, in some kind of an election, you can be sure it'll be used. The Democrats are so scared of me that they will not allow me to run. They're trying to take my right to run away from me. It becomes an argument, and it's an argument I'd rather not see him have. And if the more the Democrats insist on it, the more that it becomes potent.
Judith?
I think Alan makes a good point. I'm not super concerned about it. I think if Trump, you know, Trump almost won in November. It was very close. And the rioting mob was within inches of getting into where our elected officials were and could have caused just even greater tragedy than they did. What is it? Is it now six deaths associated with a mob running into the Capitol? So these are very difficult times associated with Trump. You know, he used the word fight 20, 25 times during his speech. I think I'm willing to take the risk of ensuring that Trump not run again. I think the people, again, who were turned off by that concept are not going to be won over anyway.
Well, again, Judith, I take some exception to that, not surprisingly, because I am not a Trump fan. I don't want to see Trump reinstalled. And I am in that group who think that you are handing the Trumpites or the Republicans an argument. And I don't want to do that.
Aaron Pasitti.
Yeah, I think there's another related issue to this. So Judith and David and Alan all mentioned that this is a public case that, you know, the impeachment managers are, you know, really presenting to the public at large because, you know, Senate Republicans made up their mind, you know, on January 6th. Part of this public case is also exposing to large campaign donors just how risky the extremist wing of the Republican Party can be, and that includes Donald Trump. So I think part of this case is targeted towards, you know, big money, for lack of a better term, that if you elect these people, this is a risk you run. And for large corporations who are investing, you know, billions of dollars in politicians and policies, that becomes a much larger gamble than with your, you know, average run-of-the-mill pro-business conservative. So even if Trump has the ability to run again, I think you might see a drying up of campaign money for him in addition to institutional Republican support. So like Judith said, I think there's another dimension to Trump's political wounding.
I don't know that we're done seeing the political wounds. Can I just, you know, can I just remind everybody that we're not even 1 month into this administration, the new administration, and thus far, and I have to applaud the current administration and their, you know, focus on COVID. They've been knee deep in there. So we have not yet heard any of the fallout of what they uncovered upon taking over. I guarantee you that once we're pretty settled and we start to see some movement here on our efforts to combat this COVID-19, we're going to start to see more information trickling out about just what this administration found upon taking office, which will further damage, you know, Donald Trump and his future in any form of government, as well as his ability to be influential within the Republican Party. At least that's my take.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. My rationale is, look, Trump is now damaged goods. I don't want to see him getting any help seeking reelection. But I do think you're right, and that we're already beginning to see that this riot that occurred at the Capitol has roots, and that the Trump people have connections to those roots. And that is going to be the death knell, as it should be, for any future candidacy. That's the way I see it.
Judith?
I have nothing else to say.
All right. Let's go to some letters, and we will do that. We welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Richard writes to us and says, according to sources, many of the Republican senators walked out of the trial while evidence was being presented. How can they vote as informed jurors? Should they be disqualified? Rhetorical question, of course. Well, they also had a meeting with the defense team, right? Yeah.
Three
so,
of them did. The worst three.
The cats.
Yes.
They met with the cat lawyers. not letting that go. And most of the people have no idea what I'm talking about.
Do you want to explain it?
Sure. So the other day on Twitter, there was a video of a legal case being heard on Zoom. And one of the attorneys getting ready to speak to the judge somehow had a filter on his computer that made him look like a cat. And there was a rather hysterical minute where he explained to the judge that he wasn't a cat, he was a live person, and it seemed like he wanted to argue the case with the cat filter still on. And I'm not doing it justice. Just everyone, don't leave the show, but maybe on a commercial break, go look it up.
All right.
Well, there's the best thing to be learned there, Judith. There's a lesson to be learned there, because apparently it was a child who had been playing on the computer before this very distinguished attorney had gone on to make his arguments. And he just could not figure out how to take the filter down, which is something that I could empathize with.
I'm looking forward to your next Zoom trial, David. I'm gonna tune in.
I'm going to be Rufus, the rooster. Rufus is going to be my filter.
Oh, Rufus is back. Alan?
Joe, if I could, we're getting a fair amount of mail, not overwhelming, but a fair amount of mail from people who I consider to be on my side of the political thought aisle, who are saying that this one trial should be anonymous. People should not be giving and we're getting, as I say, a dozen letters, that's a lot, from people who are saying, let these senators who are cowards vote, but vote anonymously. I want to say it one more time, because I truly believe these wonderful people who are writing us are just wrong. We have representative government. That's how we elect our legislators. We have to be able to hold them accountable. And just because it might be convenient this time to convict this one guy, I think it would be a major error to forget what we are and how we have established these institutions. So I just want to say that.
I agree with you entirely, Alan. You know, I think right now there's such a desperation to achieve the ultimate goal of removing this person, barring this person. And so I think as far as the writers are concerned, they are placing a tremendous amount of value, and they want a desired outcome. But I agree with you that when you have to manipulate a process in order to achieve that desired outcome, that is a slippery slope, and that's very dangerous.
All right, let's go to a few more letters here, and then we'll take a quick break. We'll go to Ned, who writes to us and says, the House managers have been amazing, but why don't they call out Cruz, Hawley, and others by name who joined with Trump to promote the big lie? Why are they so polite when it's time to name names and force them to answer direct accusations? The press will surely pick up on this and not let them slide off the hook. The accusation, do you really support a violent would-be dictator?
Well, you know, Joe, let's talk about that for a moment. You better believe these managers who have done such a wonderful job sat down and discussed that very point, right? I mean, we have to assume the question was, do they turn around and point at various jurors and name them by name? And will they alienate more than they get as a result of that? Because I've been thinking about that very point. You know, it would be something for each of them, and we still haven't seen the end and the summation of their arguments, to turn around and name senators, individual senators, you know, in Louisiana or this or that, and say, what are you doing? Or do they believe, and I'd love to hear the other panelists, do they believe that by doing that, they have no chance at all of swaying anybody?
David?
Alan, I agree with you. Listen, one of the things that I think prosecutors sometimes make the mistake is trying to prosecute the case that they want as opposed to prosecuting the case that they have. This is an embarrassment of riches when you're looking at the facts that these House managers have. And it's awfully tempting to go off in different directions and point the finger and go after a Hawley and go after a Cruz. But by doing so, you're really taking the attention off of the person that I think is you know, the biggest, the defendant in this case, which is the former president of the United States. And it would be a mistake by the House managers attempting to go off in different directions, because then you're just opening up your case to attack from a variety of different sources, where right now you have the light and you have your thumb pinned on the tail of this guy.
Judith?
Yeah, I mean, David is strategically spot on as usual. The one thing I will mention is they did kind of subtly call out Cruz in one of the video clips. They had the people who were on the floor of the Senate going through Ted Cruz's desk and his papers, and
right.
they were misreading his notes and started to say, he's going to sell us out. Cruz is going to sell us out. And then someone else, I guess, more effectively read the page and said, oh, no, he's not. And they were like rifling through his stuff at his desk. And I think that got the point across for Cruz. But, and you know, the Senate.
They broke three crayons in the process.
And they knew damn well that he was on their side. You know, one of the big things that is going to come out after this trial, and the FBI is looking into it all now, is what the level of, people getting together in order to make this thing happen
right.
is. And we're hearing more about that virtually every day. The other guy I'm looking at here is Pence. You know, all of a sudden, Pence becomes a sort of a good guy. Not to me, but he becomes a good guy because they went after him and he was only steps ahead of the mob and, you know, all of that. If you listen to the managers in this trial, it's Pence, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. they know Pence is the vice president of the United States, a Republican's Republican, and they want those votes from those people. Doesn't make any sense to do anything else, and that's what they're doing.
Yeah, it's so smart, and it was Pence and his wife and his daughter, and I think another family member that all had to be evacuated off of the floor. And I think, you know, the Pence wing of the Republican Party, which is pretty strong, cannot be happy about that, and again leads to more political weakness of the former president.
Especially since we're now.
I thought it was smart.
Yeah, please, David, go ahead.
I thought it was smart to focus on Pence because, mm-hmm. you know, who was closer to Donald Trump than Mike Pence? Who was more loyal to Donald Trump than Mike Pence? And by the way, we don't have to like Mike Pence, but Mike Pence was a victim. Mike Pence was one of the bigger victims in this case, right? I mean, the officers, first and foremost, in the I was just baffled by the not surprised, but the number of injuries that were suffered by our members of law enforcement at the Capitol.
Gosh.
But the fact that these House managers drilled down on Mike Pence demonstrated how close he came to experiencing peril. The fact that they were declaring we're going to hang Mike Pence and how close he came to meeting those people. And then you also raised the fact that his family was there, too. I love what they did there, because if you were on the fence and if you're still struggling with the constitutionality argument that the defense presented here, certainly by presenting Mike Pence in that light, I tend to think that that would be effective for more of the moderate senators.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have other letters, and we'll move on to other topics as well. Alan Shartok, Judith Eng, Aaron Pasidi, and David Soares, we welcome your letters. We'll be right back.
Oh, now feel that sun rushing through the fields and flows. Her voice coming through my dial. She's the one I swear to God, a frequency. She's got a frequency, and I caught it. All over me. Get up a train or bus or cool that far. But climb the oak tree in my backyard and I can hear it for a while. Hear how her voice bends as she smiles. Oh, now feel that sound rushing through the fields and flowers. Her voice coming.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Alan Shartok, Judith Eng, Aaron Pasidi, and David Soares. Some letters here. Alan has named the monster under the bed, says Cone. blocking Trump from running would make a martyr out of him, at least to the worshipers of the God Emperor of the United States. That is, however, a moot point, or will be, when the oath breakers and the Senate refuse to convict. Second, Judith's motion labeling Jamie Raskin a patriot, that's the proper use of the term, which has been claimed, battered, and brutalized by the white supremacists. The word is analogous to hero. No one who deserves the title claims it. Let's see. We go to Roger. I think I read this one already. Oh, it says, if Senators Graham, Hawley, and Cruz met with former President Trump's attorneys as reported, if this was a trial, it would be declared a mistrial and a new jury or jury members appointed. How can these three be replaced? Perhaps these three should not be counted, prohibited from voting, meaning that only 14.2 Republicans would have to vote for impeachment.
Good luck, Charlie. And we just
Alan, I need you on mic.
Oh, you are so right.
We just heard from Jay, who says, have Alan and Mr. Soares looked at this from the secret ballot issue from the perspective of personal safety? Trump has demonstrated his willingness to openly threaten anyone, and certainly Mr. Soares has allowed for anonymous juries when prosecuting mafia gangster defendants who, much like Trump, uses threats to win. Families did not sign up to live in fear of Trump looks. David?
Listen, I get it. And those are the things that we take into consideration every single day when we are prosecuting cases. There are cases that we've not moved forward to prosecute because we have one specific witness that everyone knows. And so if we move forward, you know, we're placing that person in jeopardy. And so we try to find other ways around that. But that's your traditional trial. These are all public public servants. These are folks that are out there with their opinions every single day. These are also people that receive personal protection. To create a secret ballot is in many ways allowing them off the hook. And so I just don't agree that when you have Senate rules that have been in place for hundreds of years, the idea that we should manipulate them in order to achieve a desired outcome, I just can't stand by that. We have to continue being a nation of laws in order to be effective and in order to carry this democracy forward.
Aaron?
You know, I think that there's a non-trivial chance that this could lead to a splintering of the Republican Party, in that you have, and I know I'm continuing to beat this drum, you know, institutional support and large campaign donors who are investing in politicians, you know, might look at the Cruises and Hawleys of the Senate as too risky and too volatile. Yes, they have the, you know, the rabid support of the base. That's important, but money is also important in terms of, you know, Senate campaigns. So, I'm kind of hoping that the impeachment trial just creates enough, independent of the outcome, which is pretty clear at this point, that it creates enough friction within the Republican Party that, you know, they don't know which way is up, and it leads to just paralysis and gives the Biden administration a chance to move their platform through Congress with relative ease.
You know, Joe, I think we have to recognize that what's happening here. I've said it before. I want to say it one more time. There was a group that were in charge, and I'm going to Aaron on this one too, that who really were the big beneficiaries of the way the economy and the economics in this country were formulated. They were in charge. They had the money, they had the power, and they had the votes. Now, that's changed. So now a group are coming up, and one of the reasons that there are so many Republicans who are standing by this president no matter what is they don't want to lose that power. It's really that simple. You can call it racist, you can call it whatever you want to, but that's what's happening.
Yeah, you know, I think that a lot of moneyed interests just wanted the 2017 tax cut, and they were willing to hold their nose and close their eyes to everything else. But I think what happened on January 6th is something you can't close your eyes to anymore. As a and it's sad, that's a sad commentary on American democracy, that Yeah, now insurrection is a legitimate risk. Big business likes stability. Big business likes mainstream pro-business Republicans, and Trump has made it very clear that he is no longer part of that camp anymore. And it'll be interesting to see if other senators start falling in line behind the party, Republican senators falling in line behind that party establishment.
I want to go back, if I can, just for a minute, Joe, to the idea of anonymous jurors. Is everybody absolutely positive that once it becomes anonymous and you don't know the way somebody's voting, that people on your side might vote differently than you want them to? There's an assumption here it's only going to be for those people in terms of the conviction of Trump. But there are some pretty miserable people out there.
Yeah, there are. Well, what do you think?
Who, me?
No, I meant, I was, no, you asked the question. I was just, I agree with you. So, no, it's a good point because it can, if it's secret, you can come back. I mean, I have to be honest, the Liz Cheney vote was secret and it wasn't, I would have thought given that cover, she would have had more supporters, but she didn't.
Well, I think people
should be forced to voice their vote. People should be forced to do it. I mean, I disagree with Lynn Cheney. I disagree with Mitt Romney more than you could possibly imagine. But I have a lot of respect for them for taking a stand, just as I had so much respect for John McCain when he came out and he cast that vote preserving, you know, the Affordable Care Act. And so I have a lot of respect for people like that. And the idea that we would somehow, you know, cloak what should be a transparent process in a government that should be transparent in order to achieve an outcome, it is a slippery slope. And remember, the rules that you set up today, you will also have to live by tomorrow.
Yep.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have a lot more to discuss. We will do that when we return. Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares will be right back. David Soares wrote during the break, he said, can't you just imagine that Sarah LaDuke is like belting out these hits into her hairbrush? And Sarah perfectly responded, hey, I have microphones, David.
Ouch.
Oh,
that was a mic drop right there.
I know. It was pretty great. It was pretty great. this is the stuff that used to go on in this room, but it doesn't anymore. It's now all done via text and email. Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome back to the program. It's very nice to have you all here. We have Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares, and we thank you for being with us. So let us talk about the story. Ray just mentioned this at the top of his news, and I think it is certainly worth discussing, and that is the story about the governor and the fact that there are a growing number of Republican elected officials calling for investigations and for the governor of the state, Andrew Cuomo, to resign after the New York Post reported on leaked video from a closed meeting between Democrats and Cuomo's top aide earlier this week. The Post reported that Secretary to the Governor Melissa DeRosa apologized to the lawmakers for the political pressure they faced over the state's COVID-19 nursing home death numbers. DeRosa claimed the administration, which had faced widespread scrutiny in a report by the state attorney general over the statistics, withheld the information because then-President Trump was threatening a federal investigation. For months, the state health department refused to release numbers of nursing home patients who died of COVID-19. Attorney General Tish James found in her report that the administration had been undercounting those who died in hospitals after contracting the novel coronavirus by as much as half. So the one thing I would like to add is, and Ray mentioned this in the newscast, but the governor's team sent us a statement from Melissa DeRosa to WAMC saying, I was explaining that when we received the DOJ inquiry, we needed to temporarily set aside the legislature's request to deal with the federal request first. We informed the houses of this at the time. We were comprehensive and transparent in our response to the DOJ and then had to immediately focus our resources on the second wave of vaccine and vaccine rollout. As I said on a call with legislators, we could not fulfill their request as quickly as anyone would have liked, but we are committed to being better partners going forward as we share the same goal of keeping New Yorkers as healthy as possible during the pandemic. A lot going on. Going to be a tough time for the governor right now, Alan.
Well, the governor has lived through other tough times. The DeRosa statement, and I like her, I know her, has been is somewhat misleading, because by the end of the statement, the long statement, we intend to be more transparent in the future. Now, if you, you know, look, if you say we behaved badly because we were afraid that the feds, the boogeyman would come and get us, that doesn't do it. It really doesn't make the case that you should have done it. Here's a good principle in politics. Never lie. Don't lie. Look, Andrew Cuomo, who I often refer to as Andrew Tough Guy, has a lot of people who are sharpening their knives right now because he's been tough on them. I get that. But you don't give them an opportunity by not telling the truth. And will he get through this? Of course he'll get through it. He's at the White House today, and he's been through worse. I consider worse when his two closest aides, you may remember, were stealing. And he didn't know it. It was a tough time. He was in a tough. It was a tough time for him when he got divorced from Carrie Kennedy. That was another tough time. And everybody thought. And the New York Post would run double truck pages about him. Do I think that this is going to cost them a lot? No. What is his? Right now, we're down to 3.5% in terms of the COVID cases, which is a feather in his cap. When people asked him, I know I'm going on, but when people asked him, people were asked in a poll, what do you think of him? He had a massive 55% approval rating. Will that go down? It will go down, no question. Nevertheless, you know, for those who are asking that he resign, that ain't going to happen.
Judith Henk.
Well, I think this is a profoundly serious issue, and there's no question that the governor worked really hard and handled large parts of the COVID response very effectively. But as outlined in the Attorney General report, he and his administration did not handle the nursing home situation well. And he's been withholding information for a long period of time. He's not been truthful. It sure looks like a cover-up. And I think Melissa DeRosa's comments yesterday didn't help. I don't think the lawmakers were looking for an apology for them being put in a politically difficult situation. I think they were looking for some answers to questions they've been posing for months. And I think going into this defensive crouch and trying to cover up information is unbecoming of a governor of New York. And at some point, the switch has to be turned where they decide they're going to, you know, provide all the information they have. They're not going to have to contend with lawsuits to get Freedom of Information Act requests answered. And you know, there are a lot of people who lost loved ones, you know, could not be with them when they died. This is a very emotionally raw issue for thousands of people. Are the Republicans shamelessly trying to exploit this? They obviously are. That's not good. But, you know, there is gambling in Casablanca, too. I think we need to stay focused on getting information out, actually being transparent, you know, and the way they're handling this latest chapter yesterday just says to me that it's business as usual. Just hide the ball and don't be held accountable for some pretty serious issues here. I think the defense that we were worried that the Department of Justice was going to go after us is just incredibly lame.
David Soares.
I have to apologize. I'm going to refrain from making comment on this particular issue, just given the fact that we're just learning about this, and in my professional capacity, and I'm not asking that you read anything into it other than the fact that I'm just going to refrain from commentary on this issue.
Well, now we're reading all kinds of things into it.
No, it's just that you know, my commenting on anything like this.
No, I understand. I understand.
You just thank you.
No, I get that too, Joe and David, but just a piece of commentary on my part, an observation on my part. The criminal justice official who is responsible for keeping his eye on, even though terribly underfunded in order to do this on purpose, accidentally on purpose, is David Soares, because he's the DA for the Capitol, and these cases are supposed to come under his purview. So I fully understand his stepping aside.
Aaron Pacitti, anything you would like to add to this particular part of the conversation?
Yeah, I'll keep it quick. I mean, this just looks bad. As Judith alluded to, once this was exposed, coming clean would have been the easiest option. The whole defensive posture is not serving anybody well, including people who have been directly affected by these actions. I think it's absolutely time to come clean and stop talking out of both sides of one's mouth.
All right. While you are up, sir, Mr. Pacitti, Professor Pacitti, I should say accurately, let us talk about deficit borrowing. The Democrats push to borrow more money as the deficit is set to shrink slightly in 2021. Don't get too excited. It isn't by that much. Top Democrats and some of President Biden's advisors are considering borrowing money to fund a sweeping infrastructure package as the nation's fiscal situation improves more rapidly than expected. This push is for a $1.9 trillion economic aid package through the House. So, Aaron, what does this how do you feel about this push to borrow money and ultimately what it does for the deficit?
So I'll lead off with what I think, and that is the Biden administration is not planning on spending enough. Deficits are complicated. Understanding deficit economics is somewhat complicated. I'm going to try to simplify that, but it's important to understand two things about the deficit. The first one is, it really doesn't matter in terms of economic performance. And second, that it is a political tool that politicians use to either dissuade people from supporting certain policies or getting them behind certain policies. The only risk to a higher deficit is higher inflation. And it's very easy to fight inflation. That's why we have the Federal Reserve. They can just raise interest rates if inflation becomes a problem. So if the government spends too much money and the deficit goes up, it overjuices the economy. And as the economy heats up beyond its capacity, then you get rising inflation. And the way policymakers deal with rising inflation is paring back spending or having the Federal Reserve raise interest rates. So the risks from a high deficit are relatively small, and we really haven't experienced any downsides to a high deficit since World War II. In fact, high deficits like happened during World War II, when one out of every $4 that the economy produced was from the deficit, led to a remarkable two-decade period of growth in the 50s and 60s. Government spending, and it really should be called government investment, can do a lot to essentially be the first move in stimulating economic performance. So during World War II, the government blew up the deficit, to, you know, expand factories, to build tanks, to hire workers. All of that investment created an industrial base, and it created a labor supply because of the GI Bill that was well-educated. So you have a well-educated workforce, and you have a much more expanded industrial base that led to two decades of very strong economic growth. So government spending and government investment in the economy can create growth. The issue isn't so much the size of the deficit. You know, the Congressional Budget Office says it's going to be, you know, $2.3 trillion, and people hear a trillion, you know, a number in the trillions, and they say, oh, the deficit's too high. Well, as a share of GDP, the deficit is high. It's about 15% of GDP, but that's because we're facing a giant pandemic with a contracting economy and layoffs and people who can't spend. So having public spending make up the gap in private spending is important. The other reason why the deficit really doesn't matter right now is that interest rates that the government pays to borrow money are so low. Right now, the government can borrow money for just over 1%, meaning if the government can borrow money at 1% and invest it in some project that has a rate of return greater than 1%, the government will be able to pay off its bondholders with interest and have money left over. So in this era of low interest rates, which has really dominated the U.S. economy since 2000, government interest payments as a share of the economy have fallen dramatically. Right now, interest payments as a share of the economy are around 2.5%. So if anything, the government is not borrowing enough to fund investment projects because interest rates are so low. Private investors are pretty much throwing money at the government saying, here, take our money. We'll accept a 1.15% rate of return by buying these bonds. The private sector is giving the government money almost interest-free, and that's a sign that the private sector wants the government to spend. The other issue I want to address is an all too often repeated fallacy, and that is increasing the deficit robs our grandchildren in that, well, we borrow money now, but it's our children and our grandchildren that are going to have to pay off the deficit. That's not true. That's only true if the government spends money and the economy gets no rate of return, that that spending doesn't create jobs, that that spending doesn't create more output. So if the government can spend on projects like infrastructure, which has a rate of return of about 8%, education, healthcare, all of these strategic investments can yield greater returns that not only don't rob our children, but actually enrich them. If the government invests money today to make for a cleaner climate and creating more jobs and having a more robust infrastructure base for the next generation, the government isn't robbing the next generation. They're actually enriching the next generation. So that's my take on the deficit.
Mm-hmm.
Biden administration should be spending and spending and spending because interest rates are so low and the U.S. economy is in desperate need of education, infrastructure, and climate investment.
So at what point do Republicans start complaining about deficit spending, even though, you know?
Oh,
they already have.
Well, right. Exactly.
Yeah. Paul Krugman has a good term. So economists call people who are opposed to the deficit, deficit hawks.
Right.
Paul Krugman has an interesting term, and he refers to Republicans as deficit peacocks, in that they, you know, they put on this big show about how much they're opposed to the deficit. But when it comes time to a $1.5 trillion tax cut, all of a sudden they're quiet. So the deficit's a political tool, and both sides, Democrats and Republicans, will marshal it to their advantage when it suits them. So you're going to all of, you know, the Republicans who were dead silent about the size of the deficit for the last 4 years are all of a sudden, now that there's a Democratic administration, are going to say, oh, we need to be concerned about the deficit. What they're really saying is, we don't want the Biden administration to spend money on programs that don't positively affect our rich donor base. That's so, my translation of what congressional Republicans are actually thinking.
Your English to financial English dictionary.
Yeah.
So let us go to some letters on this. John says, my question for Aaron is, why is the private sector willing to loan the U.S. government at such a low rate of return? It would seem to me that the reason is they don't have a better option. In other words, our prospects for long-term growth are bad.
That's partially true. Yes. The stock market obviously is very volatile. So investors who are seeking, stable medium to long term returns really don't have an option besides buying U.S. government bonds. They could buy foreign countries' government bonds, but in a lot of advanced economies, interest rates on those bonds are even lower. Buying U.S. government bonds is a very unattractive option now, but it's one of the only options for large institutional investors seeking a risk-free rate of return.
We got this from Erica, who says, if wages haven't gone up with inflation, how is inflation so important? Also, we are not talking about people all becoming millionaires. It's going to allow people to have enough, not have too much. We have never overstimulated the economy. Inflation seems a non-factor.
Absolutely. The U.S., the only time in the past century where the U.S. economy ever experienced inflation that was worrisome and had damaging results for the economy were the two oil price shocks in the 1970s. Those were completely exogenous. It had to do with OPEC. But in terms of internal inflation, inflation is not a problem, and it hasn't been. The biggest problem is that inflation isn't high enough. So, inflation is not a concern, and therefore the running up the deficit should not be a concern.
So we have just a few minutes. Does anybody else want to talk about that issue? Deficit, inflation, and the like.
I would just add that it's really important that the Biden administration go out with a very robust series of stimulus spending bills. They still haven't done the COVID rescue stimulus. Hopefully that will be very soon because people are really suffering and struggling economically. I've been doing some work on trying to get the right environmental priorities into any federal stimulus bills and just heard yesterday that they may not get to an infrastructure stimulus until this summer. Aaron and I co-authored an opinion piece in the Albany Times Union two Sundays ago that laid out why spending on things like clean energy and reducing plastic production is not only good for the environment, but good for the economy. And we've got to have a series of federal spending initiatives that tackle climate change. And so, I hope we will see that soon, and it will be almost comical to see all of the fossil fuel allies in the Congress suddenly expressing deep concern about the deficit, which we never heard from them in the last 4 years.
We did applaud you both for writing that on the show, but I don't think I ever did it to you while you were here. So great kudos for that work. We did wonder whether you wrote it during the breaks.
No.
but you make a great point, Joseph. You make a great point about so much can be done during the breaks.
Yeah, you really get a lot done. Yeah, use your imagination. David, any thoughts on this before we go to a break?
Well, just that the momentum with the Biden administration to get this done now, and they shouldn't deviate from that mission at all. And I would say that getting this done is more important right now than attempting to make this bill bipartisan.
Mm-hmm. Alan, anything on your end?
No, there's nothing on my end.
Anything you'd like to say about this issue?
No, there really isn't. There really isn't. I'm a great believer that it all works out. Franklin Roosevelt knew it. We got through World War II. We spent a great deal of money. We're spending a great deal of money on COVID right now. And all I know is that while there is supposed to be no inflation, I can't believe what it takes to buy an illegal substance, Joe, like a diet soda. Is it over $2 now? Remember Pepsi Cola?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not imbibing anymore, so I don't know. It was like $2 a bottle. Yeah.
Pepsi Cola and the end of the jingle was and a nickel too.
Pepsi Cola.
For the deposit?
No, it was the old ad. Pepsi Cola
is good for you.
It does
something
the
something and a nickel too.
Nickel, 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 trickle, trickle, trickle. Right? Wasn't that it? My mother grew up with a Pepsi Cola hits the spot.
Something.
Yeah, okay, anyway. Scintillating Radio, ladies and gentlemen. We'll have it together. We'll be right back. We're going to take a break, and we'll continue with our last call right after this. Well, good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I know you were wondering. Here you go. Here's the best we have. There you go. There you go. You remember that now, Alan?
I do. I do. That's great. How did you do that? How did you get that set that quickly?
We did it like that. There was an album that was put out years ago of old jingles, and we got it from that.
I am just grateful that Sarah LaDuke is picking the music today and not you two.
After all, Alan and I both grew up with that jingle, and we wanted to play it for you. Let's see. And
I grew up when it was a nickel.
I know. But I had old parents. By the way, we have at least 27 letters from listeners with the entire lyrics. We thank you very much. We really do. That's very nice of you.
That's your demographic, Joe.
I know. I do. It would hit. Okay. Thank you to everyone on that score. We have a couple letters on the governor's story, and I think they're fascinating because they're so opposite one another. DC says, so glad the story came out and shows how Cuomo and his minions are almost as bad as Trump's group, working to just keep the egos of the executives soothed and the truth and public be damned. That is countered by Susan's letter, who says, give the guy a break. This country and the state have never faced such a grave situation like this pandemic. The governor was working with the best information that kept changing available at the time. He kept us safe as possible. The time for accusations will be when this pandemic is under control. In the meantime, let him concentrate on limiting deaths and rebuilding the economy. So two opposing letters there from our listeners on that subject. We have a few more minutes, so let me go to...
One from Polly. Perhaps you can answer this. Family members of several Democratic Congress members, also VP Pence's, whom we know had a target on his back, were at the Capitol during the insurrection. Were there any family members of the GOP Congress people there? I have no idea. Do you, Joe?
No. Anyone?
I'm sure there were. Sure there were. People bring their families all the time.
Sure. Okay, I promised I wasn't going to read these, but then Mary wrote this one and said, this is how she remembers the jingle. Pepsi Cola hits the spot, ties your belly in a knot, tastes like vinegar, looks like ink, now you know it's a lousy drink.
I take great exception to that.
Yeah, okay, we go to...
As for me, I wouldn't have read that letter, but go ahead.
I thought it was funny that's how we actually got a couple of them that must have been a thing because there were a couple of those that came in.
But the management and staff of WAMC does not.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Secret balloting by representatives is dangerous no matter how much we might want it this one time. We cannot afford it in the long run. Again, that from Mike.
Well, that's the point. You do it once, and then you've set the precedent. It's not a good idea.
Mike says, sounds like Aaron Pasidia has been reading up on modern monetary theory, which is good. Now that we have established that deficits won't doom our grandchildren, that the U.S. government doesn't have to budget like a household, and that it should strategically invest in beneficial programs initiatives, why can't we afford single-payer health care?
Good question.
Thank you, Mike. Over the past like 5 or 10 years, one of the biggest shifts in the economics profession has been the rise of modern monetary theory, which is the argument that I just made. I just did it without mentioning the term. We can afford single payer health care. We can afford subsidized education. We can afford a $5 trillion infrastructure bill. It's not a matter of whether we can afford it. The U.S. government can print money and issue bonds. It's a matter of whether there's political will, most importantly, and that's what's lacking. It's not the economic arguments about a higher deficit. It's largely a political one that we don't want. The deficit peacocks are pretty much saying, we don't want programs that benefit all American citizens. We only want programs that benefit our campaign contributors.
And I might add that the deficit peacocks or hawks or whatever breed of bird they are called these days rarely raise these concerns when there's discussions about the military budget. It only comes up during healthcare, education, environmental protection. There's a tremendous amount of inconsistency here in the Congress.
It's just like my wife is doing all that, because she's a budgetary hawk only when I'm spending money. But every day I get boxes from Amazon and all sorts of places at my door.
Dear David, so, you just keep walking into couldn't talk about the other story, but you opened put your foot in your mouth on that one.
Don't you know that Sunday is Valentine's Day, David?
I'm just saying, man, it's like the deficit hawks in Washington. They were deficit hawks when we have a Democrat sitting in the Oval Office, but they completely abandoned the playbook and forgot how to do math when number 45 came in.
Yeah, no, that's not what you said, and you better check out 24-hour delivery for Sunday, mister.
John says, my question for Aaron is, why is the private sector willing to loan the U.S. government at such a low rate of return? It would seem to me that the reason is they don't have a better option. In other words, our prospects for long-term growth are bad.
So, yes, the reason private investors are willing to loan money to the U.S. government at exceptionally low interest rates is that there is no better option. Part of that is by design in terms of what the Federal Reserve has been doing with their bond buying programs, but also that's a result of just how the world economy has been performing over the past two decades. When growth picks up and the private sector is spending and generating growth and creating jobs, then the government can step back. That's the time to think about deficit reduction. When you have more jobs are created, the government doesn't need to spend as much money on social insurance programs, so spending goes down. And when more jobs are created, tax revenue goes up. So the deficit will naturally come down when the private sector is producing and hiring. And so when there are better options for private investors, then they will find them, and that will be perfect timing, because at that point the government will have done its job and stimulated the private sector and not be in need of money for more spending.
All right, we have one more letter, and then we're going to wrap up. Go ahead, Alan.
Can I just mention that we heard from JW, who said, Alan, Chick Corea, one of the greatest jazz pianists ever, has just passed away, and you guys haven't said a peep. You guys can do better. Okay, you write your letter of apology now, because we just did it. Thanks very much.
I wrote them back. They said it was an oversight, and I said it wasn't an oversight. We had planned it, and we'll do it on Monday. Simple as that.
Okay.
That's
good.
Yeah. No offenses taken.
By you.
No, I mean, yeah, I mean, they shouldn't take offense.
You can't say everything every day. We'll try our best. It out, and
we need time to talk about Pepsi jingles.
Yeah, we need that.
Digging the hole deeper.
You know what? I was going to read another letter. I think I'm just going to end it now while we're ahead. Yeah, I'm just going to give up. No, we did great. We did great this morning. Let us repeat and thank and happy birthday to Sarah LaDuke. We want to thank everybody for being a part of the program this morning. Happy Valentine's Day to everyone. Alan, thank you very much. To Judith and Aaron and David, thank you. Have a beautiful weekend, and we'll talk soon. We'll be right back after this.